What?
Radio.
Oh.
Radio.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio.
Thank you. again fading out in the background right there. A little bit of classic Grimes. The track was Vanessa off of the album Dark Bloom. And with that, let me welcome you to yet another edition of Intersections here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Coast Salish Musqueam territory here at the beautiful University of British Columbia campus. My name is Mel Woods. I am this year's Gender Empowerment Collective Coordinator, and I, along with a great group of volunteers, bring you this weekly hour of spoken word current affairs intersectional feminist content. That's a lot of adjectives, but they are all good ones. And we have a really fun show for you today. Whole show actually is devoted to an interview that one of our stellar volunteers, Hannah, did with the filmmaker S.B. Edwards. They talk about film and feminism and all sorts of other fun things. Film, feminism, and fun. That's the tagline for this week's episode. And so we're going to actually just launch into that right away here. And I'll be back at the end to reflect a little bit on what we heard. So this is Hannah's conversation with S.B. Edwards here on Intersections.
Hello, my name is Hannah Toms with the Intersectional Feminism Collective. I'm sitting here with S.B. Edwards. She is a independent film writer and director through her own company, Kiss Off Entertainment. She's the winner of the Script Chicks and Screencraft's Pilot Launch TV Script Competition in the comedy category. She's the winner of the Yosemite Film Festival Teleplay Competition, a winner of Sun Valley Film Festival's High Scribe Award, a winner of Praxis Screenwriting Competition. She's a recipient of a CTV National Fellowship. She's written, directed, and released a pilot for her web series Cannonball, her short film Salty, and she's in pre-production for her first feature, which is called Fall Back Down, starring Andrew Dunbar. In addition to her own projects, she has worked on a multitude of Canadian TV shows in the art department, and she was a writer on the first season of the Showcase and Netflix series Travelers. So my first question is, can you tell us about what led you to writing and directing your own films, and your biggest challenges along the way and how you overcame those?
So my background is fine arts. I went to art school in New Zealand. And I was doing, you know, different things from ceramics to metalwork, fiber arts, later photography. And then I sort of went into the work world and was traveling and came back to Canada. And I kept sort of dabbling in university programs. I sort of, you know, I thought, it's a, you know, school is a good environment to get access to equipment, essentially. So I would keep pursuing things. And that sort of evolved into interdisciplinary work and video work. And I realized, although I was really, and in some ways still am, passionate about photography, you can only tell so much of a story. You know, it's sort of a moment. And I was always pushing at that. Like, how could I express more? And that became clear that, you know, the way forward could be through writing and directing and film. And I'd always been into film and television, film festivals, pop culture. I was the coordinator in Calgary many moons ago of the Herland Film Festival. So it was a really slow, organic process. And, yeah, I think it really crystallized with some secret writing, where I didn't tell anyone I was writing. And then when I did show it to people, I got the feedback in the sense that it was reasonably good. And then I started to feel braver about showing it. And, I mean, it's funny hearing your intro to me. Because I did actually, I mean, that sounds all sounds great. I did actually have, like, a kind of slightly bitter description. I think it was on my Twitter handle of, like, professional contest winner. I actually think that's like a very real situation for a lot of female creatives, is that we're caught in this loop of trying to prove or get some kind of validation that we are good, but we never get hired. We don't get the gig. You know, if I'm standing next to the typical, you know, what people think of as the typical writer, you know, he has like a 90% better chance of getting the gig than I do. And yeah, it's like, it's very real. Like, you feel it. It's not like we all go running towards the glass ceiling with great gusto and getting all the opportunities. It's hard from the first steps that you decide to do this. It's like swimming upstream.
Yeah, during the Vancouver's Queer Film Festival a few years ago, I went to this panel that was hosted by a number of women involved in North America's independent film industry, and it was about, like, women's role in the independent film industry in North America, and a lot of the discussion was around how difficult it is for women in the independent scene to, like, get their stuff out and get their voices heard and get their stories heard.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's sadly such a common repeating tale. I've thought about this a lot in different ways, and it's sort of an ongoing exploration into the whys and the hows, because it's all a bit subtle, you know? It's all cultural. It's a complicated thing, and I think a big part of it, I've come to the conclusion, is that most people don't think they're sexist. So they're not changing anything, but I would challenge all the producers and anybody who has any sort of decision-making power to do, like, an actual forensic audit of the opportunities they've given, because that's where the whole thing falls apart. Like, I have loads of people who've championed me, who've been encouraging, who've, you know, I've had meetings after meetings with, but when they have a real live, working, paid, credit-based opportunity, I don't get it. And I can't build a career on compliments and good wishes. So that's, I think, part of the problem. Also, you have this other parallel thing working against you, I think, for anybody who's, like, overlooked or oppressed or in a minority, which is you somehow manage to make and do these good works, exceptional works sometimes, and it's like, it's crickets. It's literally like it didn't happen. And there's no, you know, there's no fanfare. There's nobody. Whereas, again, like, you know, that privileged group that you watch, they do one thing and it might be sort of mediocre or good, but whatever. And there's just literally people falling all over themselves to give them something or bring them or, you know, what about this? Could you, you know? And that's, I think, another really strong oppositional force, is that your work and what you do is sort of invisibilized. It's really frustrating.
So it's not, like, overt, explicit sexism. It's more kind of, like, subtle and, like, not talked about, but it's still there.
Oh, my gosh. I call it, like, well, and I'm not the only one, but, like, my expression is, like, death by a thousand paper cuts. You know, it's like a day in, day out, hour in, hour out, meeting in, meeting out, feeling of, like, just not getting anywhere and not being taken seriously. And of course there's been exceptions, but, you know, I've been doing this a long time, and the stats are terrible, and it feels that way. And I'm really happy now to be able to just talk about it. Like, I love now that I'm not just being, like, a Debbie Downer, and I don't have to do, like, a Pollyanna thing, and I can just, like, it's nice that it's sort of on the table that this is very fucked up and it feels really bad.
So, like, I've heard talk amongst women in, like, arts industries that there's pressure, like, as an underempowered group or, like, a minority in industries like that, there's a pressure on women to, like, be as good as they possibly can and always be perfect, because they'll always have to surpass the men that they're competing with in order to be heard. It's like, I heard a woman say, like, who's involved in the improv community in Vancouver, that, like, she's the only female improviser on her team. The rest is all men. And, like, if she fucks up, people are going to be like, oh, she's just a token. So she has to be perfect all the time. She always has to be on her game. Like, she always has to be, like, on par, if not better than all the men on her team in order to feel, like, validated. Is this something that you experience in the film industry as well?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's a lot of the talk, right? And people banding together and kind of keeping your morale up, because nobody can thrive under those conditions. Like, it's just awful when it's already a creative endeavor and you're already vulnerable and you already feel so much self-doubt because of all these messages, you know, that you're lesser. And then, yeah, to feel, you know, there is definitely a sense that, like, one screw up and you're kind of going to be kicked to the lions. Absolutely. I think it's good to do your own mental kind of, like, big badass kind of talk. Like, and I do think coming from, like, an underground counterculture environment and like punk rock and I think that that has been so helpful to me to, like, not really care. Like, of course, it stings, but also, like, fuck you, you know? It's really great to remember that what other people think of you, unless you need them or care about them, and then it's on another level, but, like, whatever. Like, too bad, you know, moving along. And that's, of course, like, way easier to say than do, but I think it's great to have, like, some people around you who will just remind you that you are fighting the good fight. And because it feels crappy, you know, like, we talk all the time about getting challenged, getting constantly undermined, how you know, you turn red and your knees shake and you have to say something, and you don't want to be in that position, but, you know, that's, like, fighting the good fight.
So it sounds like there's kind of a community of women in the independent film industry in Vancouver that kind of, like, support each other and work with each other to overcome this oppression.
I would say that people probably find their own friendships, you know, like, it's a pretty organic affair, and then you'd have wonderful groups like Women in Film, Women in Film and Television in Vancouver, and Resources, you know, they do workshops, but I'd say generally, for me, just personally, it's just some key people, and we kind of keep each other afloat. It feels like a lot to be navigating all of this negativity. We all just want to do what we feel we're here to do. You know, we just want to thrive, and we're hard workers. And I'm surprised that people even make it as far as they do. You know, I'm shocked when people keep going after years and years of kind of not ever really breaking in or spending all their savings to make a piece of work that's kind of ignored.
Can you tell us more about Women in Film and TV in Vancouver? Was that the name of the organization?
Yeah, it's WIFT,
okay.
With a V at the end, Vancouver. And they have these breakfast mixers. I think it's like 8:15 in the morning, the first Tuesday. I think this needs to be checked, but the first Tuesday of each month. They just ran a producer's workshop. That's super, super comprehensive, and they publish, periodically they publish, like, a whole book on how to produce things, and this, again, is, like, trying to, you know, speak to the idea of, like, do it yourself, you know, like, trying to give women and anybody, you know, allies, whomever, the tools to start carving their own way in.
So because of all the, like, sexism and difficulty getting into the industry that you described, is that the reason you started your own production company? Were you just kind of like, F this, I'm just going to do my own thing? Or?
Yeah, and it took a really long time. Like, it's funny because I've always been pretty politicized, and at the same time I've been sort of sheltered because I had, like, an amazing grandmother in my life and raised by, like, a single mom who was very, like, did what she wanted, and I was almost raised in this bubble, like, oh, racism and sexism, like, that's such an old-fashioned thing from the past, you know? And then it takes a while to kind of wake up and get that this is so real, and this is, I remember it was almost like a moment when I kind of clicked in, and I was like, oh my God, this explains everything. Like, it just all makes sense. And even then, it's still, you know, to figure out what to do about that is pretty tough. You get a lot of women trying to, keep getting educated. Meanwhile, there's critics who are saying, like, oh, stop going to school and just do it, in this very entitled way that they obviously don't understand. And essentially, there was a really wonderful moment about, I'm not sure if it's like over a year ago or something now, where Telefilm, our funding body for film, CRTC is the equivalent in television, and they're both funded by Canadian Heritage. They saw that their stats were as bad as anywhere else. They had like a 10% female creative and narrative fiction. Women often get marginalized into documentary, and the NFB, you know, can support women, but in animation, but that's just really not everyone's jam, you know, or family, you know, MOW. So basically they were like, okay, this isn't fixing itself. And they mandated parity by 2020. And if I understand it correctly, it's at least, 50% projects, creative projects, will be spearheaded, and that means writing, directing, not producing, by women. And I hope that means women identifying. I would hope so. And then I think it also means or will mean 50% of the money will go towards those projects. Because, again, that's the other thing that happens, right? If you always just get, like, the tiny, low-budget stuff as a female creative, then it's not as impressive, you know? It's, again, like, just another paper cut. but that was a game changer. And then, you know, the, like, Fall Back Down, the film I wrote and I'm directing, is in this stream of funding that used to be called micro-budget. Now it's called Talent to Watch, which is flattering and better branding. And they have that. You know, they're really actively pursuing female creatives and people of color and trying to get that diversity, inclusivity coming into the fold. So that changed things. I mean, I wrote on season one of Travelers, but I wasn't asked back for season two. It was actually a really great experience, and I love television and want to write TV, and I have a few of my own projects that I'm advancing. But in terms of, like, really mobilizing and forming my own company, that was a result of sort of the two things, like Travelers season one. Then I had the confidence to sort of open my own shingle, which is what all writers do when they start writing on TV. They form a company, and then that company is now like an umbrella for what I want to be the future for me and what I do, which is totally DIY, like just going around the gatekeepers. We're not even gonna pursue like traditional distribution.
As someone with insight into the film industry in Canada, are you seeing those changes already? Like in the level of diversity?
That's a good question. You know, I'm always trying to keep kind of an eye out, but I work a lot, you know, to try and like live in Vancouver, and I work in the art departments on IATSE shows, and when I'm doing that, which is a lot of the time, and then trying to write and do things in the margins, I don't have like a huge amount of community involvement. You know, it just falls a bit by the by, but I definitely have seen my peers and people that I know and I've met through Women in Film and other, just, you know, however. I do think there's a little sense of, like, it unblocking, you know. It's nothing drastic so far. I mean, it is actually the fifth year of the micro-budget program. And Ashley McKenzie did a film called Werewolf with all non-actors. She's from Victoria. I saw her speak on a panel. And then she got on the list of TIFF, like, top 10 to watch. So I can imagine a scenario where she would not have necessarily, potentially, right? Like, I think micro-budget, the fact also that they don't get involved creatively and you do your thing, I do expect that that should unblock some of the stuff, because it's a real thing, and I feel it even now when we're going into prep and we're making deals with, like, camera houses, and it's just, like, it's all so real instead of all those years of, like, you know, it's like a dragon. Like, you believe in it. You talk about what it looks like, but then, you know, then when you get money and things start rolling and it's greenlit and there's a start date and you're talking to people about what crew position they're going to have and casting, like, it all starts to the magic, which, I mean, that is sort of why we all get, for better or worse, you know, we're in this industry. You feel it, you know, it's like, okay, this is happening. And the cool thing is, because we are in charge, like I say we, because I have a great team, producer Rochelle Benz and a really strong production designer, AJ Josipovich, who is super involved with a lot of the stuff that we're doing on the producer side. And then we have Andrew, the lead, who's also, you know, he's an EP on the project. So we are ourselves trying to, like, fulfill those expectations. So we are actively trying to crew and cast in an inclusive way. And I'm just like, okay, if this might be the only power, like, I'll ever have, hopefully not, but, you know, yeah, I have my own company and we're making this movie and the movie's set in this context, and, like, let's, you know, bring it all the way through holistically, which is just so awesome. It's such a great feeling to finally be able to enact some of your personal values.
You mentioned rejection, and I feel like that's such a huge part of being involved in the film industry. Like, I know a lot of people in the acting community in Vancouver, from what I hear, is just, like, constant rejection and, like, constantly having to deal with that, but, like, also find a way to pick yourself up after that and keep going.
Yeah, I mean, actors, oh my gosh, you're made of strong stuff, you know? And there's definitely lessons to be learned there with the idea of just letting it go. I think, you know, even just as we're talking about it, I'm sort of thinking, like, it's good to remember, and I'm trying to remember, like, these are great problems to have. Like, how much better it is to get rejection, like, further along and higher up the totem pole than to just not even have, because there's a long time when you're just kind of, like I said, it's sort of like a castle, you know, with, like, no way in, and you're just standing there looking at the moat, and you don't even get, you know, and then if you can sort of start taking a kick at these things, they're not going to be perfect, and they're going to be strange and lumpy like everything else, but that's okay, you know, that's part of it, and you're still cutting your teeth, and you're still, you know, you're getting better at your craft.
You mentioned how you self-distribute your films. Can you tell us a bit about what that looks like? Like, what platforms you use, how you distribute your stuff, and also, like, you have a super big social media presence. Can you talk to us a bit as well about, like, how you use that to promote your films?
I'd love to. Yeah, this is what I'm super jazzed about right now, and I was really hoping that we could talk about it, because I kind of feel like, for once, I'm in front of something, like I'm ahead. And there is a little bit of a Wild West thing that these frontiers have not been figured out. And if you are ready to go into them and try and crack this puzzle, you know, good things await. Because I always feel like I'm, like, behind, you know, and things have already came and gone. And being able to afford a house, like, well, you know, it used to be that way, but forget it, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, like, some of the most interesting things I think to know is I've yet to hear of any filmmaker who went with traditional distribution, even a small distributor, making any money. This is like this weird secret that people don't talk about, and they reframe the conversation to be like, well, it's for exposure and this and that. And look, everyone's got the right to make up their own mind about what's worth it to them, and certainly exposure is something. But, like, I want to get paid. I want to make another movie. I don't want to have to fully go back to, although probably have to somewhat go back to groveling and, you know, filling out applications. But, you know, there is the feeling that our team is, like, we're all kind of getting more and more educated on this. And basically, you don't have anything to lose, because the other way broke down a long time ago, but a lot of artists and people are still swept up in this myth that, you know, they're going to go with a distributor and then the rest is going to happen. But the distributors still want you to do a photo gallery. They want you to provide assets. They often want you to go to the festivals on your own dime. These are all the things we're going to be doing, but, like, what? Like, is, you know, there's a part where you start scratching your head and you're like, okay, so, like, what? And you know, talk to some distributors, because I'm sure they have, like, you know, this is just one side of the story. But it's a lot of, like, bad feelings out there towards distributors. And I know it's tough for them, too. But I almost feel like it's kind of like you're going to get fleeced. And if you decide that's worth it, great. But there's new platforms like services, essentially, Distribber, and services like that, where you can pay a flat fee, no revenue share, for them to prepare your film to come out on, like, iTunes, Google Play, Xbox, and it's a flat fee. Starts around, you know, don't take this as, you know, gospel, but I think it starts around, say, $1,600, and then, like, you add $300 sort of per extra if you add Hulu, if you add edit. So, like, ultimately, that's not, you know, that's not bad. And festival submissions, you probably still want to do those, but, you know, those add up also. So then you can actually get your film out there into the world. The flip side is, you know, then you're not just making the film, you're also marketing the film. And that's like 50% should be 50% of your work. Hence the social media. And we're just in a really grand experiment right now, so I don't have all the answers, but it's really exciting. It's exciting to think that, you know, we can show a little bit of, like, what we're trying to do. And I mostly put stuff about tone and, like, just things that I think are kind of on point with the film and myself on our Instagram. And to me, it's like I want to hopefully create some sense of confidence in the people who are interested that this might be a good movie. And I used to be really private. I'm not anymore. So that's something to be aware of. I think it is the work. You know, documenting things, sharing things is part of making your film if you're going to do it this way. So I've actually loved it. Like, I didn't know how I was going to feel about that. But I find it's fantastic. Like, there's so many amazing makers of things and interesting people and travelers and wanderers who I'm so happy to, like, you know, have these little snapshots through social media into their world, and then to think that we could maybe communicate directly with our audience, and maybe they'll even come back. You know, hopefully next I'm going to be doing a lesbian horror film, and it sounds really different from Fall Back Down.
Sounds amazing.
In some way. Thank you. Oh, long overdue. You know, but I do think with a kind of sensibility, like, that's Kiss Off Entertainment, you know, like, there'll be a kind of sensibility, and hopefully people will come and check out that one as well. So, you know, it's kind of to be determined, I don't know, but maybe in a year we can talk again and I can tell you, like, how it went.
Yeah, and, like, social media, it's almost, it seems like it's a burden, like, living in the age of self-distributing with social media, because it's like, then in order to get your stuff out and in order to get noticed, and, like, particularly with the younger generation, you have to have, like, a social media presence. But at the same time, it's such a, like, creative outlet. Like, I was checking out your Instagram and your blog and all your stuff about, like, the style of the characters in the film. Like, it really makes the characters in your films come to life and, like, gives such a good understanding to me of, like, what the vibe of the film is and what the characters are like. And it's really cool. It's almost like they're real people with their own, like, real social media presence.
Well, thank you so much.
No worries. And it looks like so much fun to put together as well.
I have so much more creativity in my life now, like, and even people on the team, you know, we're like, we need some drawings. We're going to print some envelopes because we're going to do a fundraising store, which is a little bit like, you know, with, like, World Wildlife Foundation, if you donate, you get a stuffy. We're going to sort of do something like that.
Okay.
So there'll be, like, levels with perks. And we're just planning that right now. But I was like, why have a plain envelope to mail it out in when we could put something cool on it? So then AJ is like, oh, actually, I got out my sketchbook since you said that, and I've been sketching some stuff.
Oh.
And so we have this really cool skeleton hand that she drew on one of our envelopes. And and then I drew, you know, this sort of hand coming out of a coffin that
oh,
I love.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is the kind of dead inside motto, which is a slightly personal mantra. But, and also not dead, you know, like, dead inside, but also, like, still fighting. And that's on another envelope. And it's, like, really small things, but we actually get, like, such a kick out of it. And planning little photo shoots for, you know, we've got some jewelry. And I don't know, man. It's been, like, it's been really great. And it's been really rewarding. And it's part of why I love advocating for this way. Because also, like, what if we can get rid of the gatekeepers? Well, get rid of them might sound hard. But, like, what if I don't need or care or they don't matter if they think that my stuff is something nobody would watch, which is the big problem. You know, it's like a bunch of the same people thinking they know what everyone wants.
Yeah, because it almost seems to be a cycle, like, in the mainstream. This is another thing that came up in the Women in the Film Industry panel that I went to, that, like, it's primarily just over-empowered, like, over-privileged groups, predominantly white men who get their, like, screenwriters who get their stories out. So then, like, the only stories that, like, mainstream consumers of, like, film and TV are used to or, like, the white male perspective. So then, like, that's what distributors and, like, mainstream producers think people want, because that's what people are, like, used to, and that's what they like because they've only been exposed to that. So, like, they don't think that people would be interested in a different perspective. But, like, films with alternative perspectives that we haven't seen before are so interesting and, like, I feel would be so popular to, like, a wide portion of the population, like, if they were to be exposed to it. You know
what
I mean?
Like, should those things ever see the light of day,
exactly.
Let's say.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that that's, like, a huge problem with the whole feeling that, like, it's so boring. Like, it's all so boring.
Yeah, it's like, we've seen this before. We know this plotline. Yeah. Like, yeah.
We're all just dying of boredom. And, like, anything that's entrenched, you know, that thing is not going to want to die, and it's not going to want to go down. And I've been hashtagging lately, or just saying in posts, like, you know, this privilege is not going to redistribute itself. So I do think a certain amount of, like, strategy and sort of going after it is necessary, because we can have great discussions, and those discussions are complicated, of course. But, you know, for things to really change, there needs to be some systemic adjustments. And unfortunately, that's a slow process, especially, like, going back to what I said before, nobody thinks they're part of the problem.
Mm.
And there's a lot of evidence that diversity, like, a lot of the stats are coming out now that that's absolutely not true. You know, like, all these things that have shut people out are based on literally nothing, bad information. But they still had the effect of, you know, like, people didn't get those opportunities. So it was still real, even though, you know, there's no time machine to kind of undo that. But there's definitely, you know, some good hard facts to show that people don't want that. If they ever did, they don't want it anymore, and they certainly don't want it 100% of everything. Mm-hmm. And I heard an interesting story, actually, about there's a female filmmaker, writer, director out of Halifax called Danishka Esterhazy. I met her. She's lovely. I met her, like, once 100 years ago at one of those mixers, the women in film things. And she had done a really lovely film in 2010. I saw it. I watched it. I made a point of watching it at the time, called Blackfield. And it turned out great. Was awesome, small budget, really good performances. And this is just me retelling the story. So the story goes, it might be becoming, you know, larger and more legendary, but she didn't get distribution. And back then, that was sort of, like, all you could do. So she didn't get distribution. Basically, it was just a chorus of, like, we don't think anybody would want to watch these two female leads in a rural location. Like, there's nobody who wants to see that. Okay. So what can you do? Life goes on. She does other things. And just sort of on a lark, I'd imagine, like, 5 years later, a couple years ago, you know, that Amazon is, like I said, it's this platform now where you can kind of self-publish. People self-publish their books, but filmmakers can also put their stuff up if they go through this. It's pretty rigorous with the specs, but if you can get your assets sorted out, and there's services that do that, you can bring your thing out on Amazon. So she does. And it just starts going gangbusters. Like, I think her price point was really reasonable. That's important. So, yeah, it was getting tons of views. It got to the point that Amazon noticed, because it was always on the top of the charts, I guess. And then they invited her to be part of Amazon Prime. And part of that, I think, or I don't know if these are two different things, but anyway, they had a program where they would, you know, sort of bring you into the fold for, like, $100,000. And that's much better than most distributors are offering, like, by far. So she gets $100,000. She goes on Prime, where it just goes even more nuts. And it apparently, you know, directly led to her film that she's doing now. And this is all, you know, the same movie that people were like, yeah, nobody would watch that.
Your films seem to have really, like, eccentric and unusual characters in them, like, characters that we're really not used to seeing in the mainstream. What is it about characters like that that interest you and inspire you to write?
Yeah, I'm really big. Like, pretty much my whole jam is, like, outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, you know, those are my people, and those are the interesting people. And I'm just shocked that people don't know this. Or maybe they do, but they are the voices that are, you know, part of this mass exclusion. So we're not seeing much of that. And of course, you know, we do with Festival Darlings, and thank goodness. But yeah, I think it's really weird, personally, that you know, I live in East Van and I go to LA and spend some time there. And like, I don't know, even if people aren't super hardcore anymore, you know, they were once and they still have these values that like the world can be a better place. There is like a lot of people at various stages of looking and behaving and occupying at this space of, I don't know what you would call it, but like people with tattoos and, you know, stretch piercings and not to say they all, you know, not to lump everyone together, but like, and musicians and artists, and I see people like that like everywhere, you know, the like I see dead people. No, I see like these people and yet I never ever see them on television. And this has been like now everybody in all of that spectrum are like getting gray hair, having kids. It's like been so long that they've been not represented in media. It's disturbing. You know, I felt like that should have happened, started happening 20 years ago. But I sometimes wonder, is this like a baby boomer smothered them sort of thing? Like the baby boomers still seem to define what counterculture was, and it's a really romanticized version of like the 60s, which I don't know. Like, I don't even know what to say to that. You know, good work was done, but I mean, that was a long time ago. And young people are doing like amazing things right now. And like, so much is happening on the street, and so much is happening in grassroots movements. Like, everything, everything. And yet, why has this not, even a bad representation of it might possibly be better than like complete absence, you know? And I mean, it's kind of shocking, you know, especially because a lot of the people that you're talking about are really impacting culture, and they're really impacting democracy, and they're really making a difference in our society. They're active minds and active people. I see it as like a noble thing, you know. I'm less involved with politics than I used to be, and I always think that people who stuck to their guns and like really kept those hardline values that I admire are like nobility. That's like the hardest thing to do. I wasn't really able to do it, but like what I want to do with Kiss Off Entertainment and with Fall Back Down is like show that in a glorified light, because to me this is the good fight, you know. And yeah, like the, you know, the stupid thing of like, oh, somebody scary is gonna go in a plot line, you know, gonna go steal some lady's handbag, oh, let's give him a mohawk, you know, that's like so dumb. You're way more likely to get robbed blind by like some corporate guy taking all of your savings than, you know, like most mohawk come with the most lovely personalities.
It's so true. Like, I, like, now that I'm involved in the independent music scene in Vancouver, which is like the center of like alt culture in Vancouver, it seems like that's where I meet the most eccentric people. And like, what you just said is so true. Like, I have never met a more inclusive and like kind and accepting group of people. Like, you walk into a music club, like a independent, like Toast Collective or like Stylus Records or the Redgate Review Stage, which is now unfortunately shutting down and probably being replaced by like bougie boutiques, which says a lot about gentrification in Vancouver, but that's a whole other topic. But yeah, like you walk in and people you don't even know just like talk to you and are like, come hang out, like, what's your name, what are you into, and like just like the nicest, like most supportive group of people, and like the bands there that play are just also supportive of each other, and there's just this like so supportive and kind community. And yeah, like you said, the way that people with like mohawks and piercings and tattoos are represented in the media is the total opposite of that, and it's like absolutely untrue.
It's really a head scratcher, honestly, and how it's perpetuated this far and this long. And I'm really excited. Like, that's the thing, is I really hope Fall Back Down can be successful. I hope we can hold on to this momentum that we have going, because I have like so many more stories, you know, with people who I think reflect that. I feel like it's almost like a utopia, almost like a secret utopia. And sometimes I sort of almost feel like, you know, don't tell those people, don't tell those people on the right, like, how great it is over here, yeah. You know?
Because we want to, like, keep it as our own thing.
Yeah, like, keep put on the DL.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty great, you know, it's pretty wonderful. And thank goodness, because, you know, you do need a lot of support when you aren't always welcomed that way into, you know, the mainstream and traditional contexts. Like, you do feel like the outsider. But when you're in that world, I mean, it's wonderful.
So I saved the questions about your upcoming film, Fall Back Down, to the last. Could you just give us, like, a general overview of, like, what the film's about and why people should come see it or should see it on, like, the platform that you're using to distribute it?
Fall Back Down is a punk rom-com. It could also be called, like, an activist rom-com. It could be called an outsider rom-com, but... it is mostly a rom-com. So it has a punk house, family of friends. Part of their membership is our lead, Nick Colby, who starts out being, you know, really full-on black bloc protester, right at the front lines, like, you know, keeping people safe, helping protesters not get hurt, which is how I think a lot of the black bloc work is like that. It's actually, like, kind of taking the hit for unsuspecting, newly politicized protesters, you know. So they throw back, like, the canisters, and they make a point of being at the front line, and they're actually kind of tactically usually trained and have workshops, so they can see if, like, the police are starting to corral people and try to keep an exit open. There's all sorts of interesting stuff. Of course, they have a bad rap, right? And there's not one black bloc, so it's totally open, and it's different in different countries and cities. Okay, anyway, in our version, Nick and his, like, family of friends are doing this good work, and then he gets heartbroken by his girlfriend who, you know, was right up there beside him. It's not even a breakup because she goes overseas and he's just sort of left in this purgatory. They haven't broken up. He's not hearing from her, and essentially we pick him up, like, a year later, where he just doesn't give a shit, like, about anything. And I feel like it's that very familiar sort of place where, you know, when you get hurt, a lot of stuff can just sort of, like, go out the window with that, like, your hope and your idealism and everything gets shattered, not just your frail
heart. Yeah.
And so, you know, he's just doing his own thing, getting shitty jobs, getting fired, whatever. And he finds his way into a sweatshop in the garment district.
And it takes place in Montreal, right?
I mean, yeah, you know, we're sort of rethinking, because that's where I wrote it. We're sort of rethinking that only because we can't really afford to go out to Montreal. So I think we're going to make it, like, a Montreal-like place. Maybe not get too specific, just because we have to be super mindful of the budget, and it's not really a story point. Like, I think as long as it has the feeling of somewhere where there would be this, you know, counterculture, which is pretty much every city now, but the flavor is Montreal. And in this place, there's a worker, a younger worker, South Asian named Rina, who, you know, just takes one look at him and, like, doesn't like him and doesn't want him there and speaks her mind to that effect. But, you know, he's not, like, really ready to just take his marching orders. So the spark of conflict between this feud that kind of fires up with them, I think it just kind of fires him up a little, you know, gets a little ember going in the black heart. And then there's a workplace accident where clearly something really bad has happened. And then we go into a kind of investigative, capery sort of second act where they are trying to figure out, like, what happened and to whom, and getting closer. You know, like, the usual tropes of I believe in, you know, kind of, I think when people go to see a certain genre, they bring expectations, and I always like to fulfill those. And at the same time, as I'm going along, hopefully what people will find, because I have tried to do this, is that I'm also kind of subverting things as we go along, you know, different points. And there's a musical.
Oh my gosh.
Which I'm so excited about. Yeah, like a Bollywood musical.
What? Like within the
in
film?
In a factory. Well, because we have a factory. And
oh my gosh.
It's like, it just wants to happen. It wants to be
oh my
there.
Gosh, that's so funny.
I wrote that. Yeah, it's so great.
It's amazing.
We're just planning that, like some, you know, figuring out some choreography and yeah. stuff. Yeah, so, yeah, and then, you know, they get closer, realize they quite like each other, and then Lizzie, the woman who broke his heart, comes back mm. and wants him back. Of course.
Yeah, of course. So do you have any idea, it might be really vague right now, but do you have any idea when we can expect to see this released?
Yeah, so in a perfect world, the idea is to drop on those platforms and on the website, on the www.fallbackdownfilm.com, to have the film become available as close as possible to our festival premiere. And we don't know exactly what festival we'll get into. I mean, I'd love to get into Berlin or Sundance, of course, mm-hmm. and like South by Southwest is really cool. So depends a little bit like when we get in, but let's say we get into Berlin. That would be like the very beginning of 2019, which sounds a long way away. But when I think about how quickly we got, like things came from us mm-hmm. getting the funding to now it's happening, it's very fast. And we'll do some stuff along the way. You know, like we'll do the fundraising store and we'll maybe create some other content along the way. But essentially, the idea is that I would love if, like, everybody who's into this film can kind of be there for the premiere. So it depends, you know, what iTunes, if they steer a lot of the timeline stuff. And the festival, they have some rules about things not being available online digitally. But if we can just get those as close as possible together, early 2019, and I want to sell the movie for like $4.99, and I hope we can. I have to still check with iTunes whether they'll allow that.
So, like, if you were to give advice to an aspiring filmmaker, especially a woman who's trying to break into Canada's independent film industry, what would be that advice?
I would say, you know, do be aware and give yourself some support, knowing that, like, sexism is real. It's not you. It's not that, you know, your work isn't as good. It's not that you need to do better or have a better education or, you know, it feels harder because it is harder. And it's important to not internalize that. There's these great memes, you know, like, know your worth. And I didn't understand those at all until I kind of got them into that context, which it's tough because we tend to evaluate our worth based on, you know, what opportunities we get and the validation we get. So I would say just, you know, screenwriting and filmmaking is a craft, like construction or anything. You know, like, work on the craft and find some people that you trust who will give you the truth and keep trying to get better, get feedback. You know, it takes a while usually to become a better writer, and that's part of breaking in, but just keep at it. And I would say, you know, explore this idea of DIY distribution. You know, I kind of turn over every rock. I try every angle. Contests, still do those. Just take everything you can think of and take a run at it and a kick at it, because it is a bit of a numbers game as well. A really big thing, I would say, it's very easy for your work and your projects to get tied up and end up on a shelf somewhere with this emphasis of partnering up with producers. And there's a lot of producers, and a lot of them can't get much done. It's just like they're in a similar boat in some ways. So my big thing that I do now, and I think is a really great approach, is when you have something, whether it's a treatment or a script or whatever, if you have reached a point with the producer where they want to shop it or try to get funding for it, they want an option, which is just industry speak for an agreement that they'll have an exclusive right to shop your project and try to get it funded for X amount of time. They all use this, like, 2-year benchmark, and then it sometimes gets stretched out further because they say, you know, well, by the time we apply, telefilm need 2 years, da-da-da-da-da. Next thing you know, you're signing a $1 option for 3 years with people who you've never really worked with. Everybody has a million stories of, like, how then you can't really do anything. That project can't do any really work for you except maybe as a writing sample, a confidential writing sample. So my thing that I learned sort of the hard way is make your option contingent on the funding. So usually they want an option to go apply to Telefilm or some, you know, funding body. So basically what you can do is say, okay, this option will become a 2-year option if you get the funding. And Telefilm does accept those because I've done it. Because they want the producer to have 2 years to get more money together and bring it to a place where they could try and go into production. And that's fair enough. You know, 2 years is appropriate. But it's not really appropriate, especially because half the time you do this deal, you do it in time for a deadline, and 3 or 4 months later they find out they didn't get the money. I mean, usually it's no. Honestly, most of the time everything is no. So now you've just given up your project for 3 years when 4 months later you find out they... And when they get the no, there's really very few options for that producer to keep. In Canada, we don't have a lot of, private money, people who give money. You know, it tends to be a lot of, like, government and whatnot funding. So your thing can sort of be dead in the water, and you also just can't do anything else with it. So I would say, yeah, go for the shortest option you possibly can based on, like, what the deadline is for the grant or the funding stream, and then just build it in that this option is triggered for a further 2 years if the grant is successful. And if not, it comes back to you. Or you can make some other arrangement with them. Maybe you give them more time later, you know, but you at least get a chance to get it back.
I think with that, we should wrap it up. Okay, so thank you so much for coming to talk to me today.
Well, it's my pleasure. I really, I enjoyed talking to you at the March, and I was really, really excited to get invited to come in, and I, it's nice to have an opportunity to, like, speak to people, and if anybody wants to reach out to us or, you know, put themselves up for casting in the film, we are looking for, you know, people with face tattoos and stretch piercings and non-binary, disabled, like, you know, we want to have this representation. So reach out through Instagram or email on the website, and we'd love to hear from people. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You just heard Hannah Toms' interview with filmmaker S.B. Edwards here on Intersections on CITR 101.9 FM. And with that, we are into the end of the program, Radioland. It has been great hanging out with you, as always, and we will be back next week with another great hour of content, 2 p.m. every Tuesday here on CITR. We'll talk to you later.
You know what's better than reading a great magazine? Reading a great magazine that also helps you fight poverty. Megaphone Magazine is sold by homeless and low-income vendors on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria. Vendors buy magazines for 75 cents and sell them for $2. It's flexible, low-barrier work for people who may not have access to traditional jobs. Download the Megaphone app to find vendors and buy the magazine, even when you don't have change.
CITR and Discorder are hiring a new station manager. Just asking for a friend, but if I know someone who would be great for this position,